This is John Quinlan, the host and producer of the Radio and Television Public Affairs program, Forward Forum. Archived versions of this and other shows can be found at www.forwardforum.net. Matt Rothschild, the executive director for the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, was the featured speaker on January 6, 2016, at a luncheon sponsored by 55 Alive, a senior supportive project of Madison's First Congregational United Church of Christ. Project coordinator and longtime community leader Tim Kale introduced Matt.
I have the privilege of introducing Matt Rothschild to our 55 Alive group today. Matt is the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. This is an organization that Rita and I are pleased to support financially every year because they do wonderful work exposing large and oftentimes secret campaign contributions for both Democrats and Republicans. It's good that we have a watchdog group like that. Prior to joining the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, which he just started last year, Matt worked for the Progressive Magazine for 32 years, as did Helen. And he was the editor and publisher there, and I've also received that magazine for 32 years and really appreciated all of his profound editorials on contemporary issues. His opinion pieces have run in the Chicago Tribune, the LA Times, the Miami Herald, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Wisconsin State Journal, and the Capital Times, and a host of other newspapers. He's appeared on Nightline, NPR, C-SPAN, and the O'Reilly Factor, which he said was an act of masochism. Or the O'Reilly Factor is on Fox News, which some of us call full news. You may have heard him on the Mike 92.1 or on the Joy Cardine Show on Wisconsin Public Radio, or may have seen him on WISC TV with Neil Heinen. Matt and I have crossed paths many times, as he is always in the forefront of struggles for peace, justice, and equality. Matt lives with his wife Jean in the town of Dunn, and when he's not tracking nefarious campaign contributions, he enjoys bird watching. Let's give a warm welcome to Matt Rothschild.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for inviting me today. Thanks for all your good work you've done in the Madison community for peace and justice for decades. Thanks to you and Rita for supporting the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. And thanks for everyone for coming. Congrats on 55 Alive. This looks like a tremendous group. It's nice to see some old friends here, including Helen Caplero, who worked at the Progressive, Kathleen Day, who fed me every Wednesday night the first couple years I was here. She and Sam Day, Sam used to work at the Progressive, and were just tremendous supports for me throughout my time here in Madison. So it's great to see everybody. You know, I'm going to be blunt. I believe in telling the truth, the unvarnished truth, the plain spoken truth, rather than sugarcoating things. So the plain unvarnished truth is that we really aren't living in a democracy anymore. Certainly not a functioning democracy. There's a formal democracy here, but the idea that the people rule in the United States is a joke right now. And Jimmy Carter himself said so 6 months ago on the Tom Hartman show when he said we've become an oligarchy with unlimited political bribery, an oligarchy. Bernie Sanders talks about this all the time. You know, there are other people who have mentioned it, but, you know, there we have it. Bill Moyers talks about it, too. He wrote an article for The Progressive a couple years ago when I was still there just called Plutocracy, that it's government by the rich. And then these political scientists have dug into this issue and come to the same conclusion, too. 2 years ago, two political scientists, one from Princeton and one from Northwestern, studied almost 1,800 policy issues over a period of two decades. And this is what they found. Now I'm quoting from their study. It makes very little difference what the general public thinks. They have little or no independent influence on policy at all. In our findings, the majority does not rule, at least not in the causal sense of actually determining policy outcomes. Basically, they studied it every issue that a majority, that almost every issue that a majority of the people wanted, but the top 1% in the business community didn't want, never happened. Just didn't happen. If the top 1% agrees with the majority of people, then the majority gets what it wants. But it does not play any kind of a decisive factor. And this is just contrary to everything we're taught as kids in high school and college, in civics classes, on TV, how our democracy is supposed to work. It doesn't work that way. So who does rule? I mean, the top 1% rules, the business community rules. And how do they rule? Well, they rule by the money they give to politicians and by the lobbyists they pay on Capitol Hill or in Madison. Let's just take a look at who's giving most this election season so far. There's an article in the New York Times recently. It said 158 families, just 158 families in the United States had given just about 50% of all the money spent on electioneering up to now during the election. Of these 158 families, 138 are Republican. That's 87%. And to me, it doesn't really matter whether they were, you know, they were evenly split or not. I mean, even if they were evenly split, our democracy isn't supposed to be a wrestling match between billionaire Republicans and billionaire Democrats, and the rest of us are just out on our own. I mean, we have billionaires picking the candidates, not us, the citizens, kind of as Lori pointed out about the money. You know, we don't have a say. We can give nickels and dimes, and they give billions and billions. You know, they kind of choose, these billionaires are choosing candidates like they choose horses for the Kentucky Derby. You know, it's a hobby for them. Their horse may not win. The horse may trip out of the gate like Rick Perry or some certain governor from Wisconsin. But at least they get their horse in the race. And we don't get that as citizens. We don't choose the candidates. We don't choose who wins ultimately, except in the most formal sense. So to a large degree, what's happening in our country is we as citizens, we've been reduced to the role of spectators. Spectators, bystanders, blindfolded spectators, because a lot of times we don't know where the money's coming from. And this is a real problem. It's a real problem for us in our sense of who we are and our sense of what our government should be. Increasingly, there's a lot of dark money going on. I think our democracy is drowning in a sea of dark money. We're not going to be able to trace it, especially with these independent groups that are spending so much. But that's where we are. And the investments are paying off for the people who are making those investments. Not you and me, but the pharmaceutical industry, for instance. They give tons of money during election time to candidates. And then they deploy an army of lobbyists on Capitol Hill. There's more than two lobbyists for every elected official in Washington, D.C., from just the pharmaceutical industry alone. And so that's why they prevail. That's why during Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, Obama agreed to say we're not going to bargain bulk prices from the pharmaceutical companies through Medicare. Or take Wall Street. I'm sure some of you have seen The Big Short. Wall Street gives a lot of money to elected officials, a lot of money to President Obama, a lot of money to Hillary Clinton, a lot of money to almost every elected official in Congress, so much so that Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois said last year the banks own this place. And the evidence of them owning it is clear, because the banks weren't split up, even though they destroyed the whole system in 2007 and 2008. And the gambling they've done with these derivatives on mortgages, those weren't outlawed. Those are still going on. And they've been made whole, whereas the 5 million people who were thrown out of their homes weren't made whole. We got nothing out of the bailout from the banks. It was possible. I mean, it's conceivable that the bailout needed to happen because the whole system was falling apart. But if the bailout had to happen, why didn't we as citizens or consumers get something out of it? Why did the banks just get $700 billion and trillions of dollars in guarantees? They could have, President Obama could have said, or President Bush before him, who set the thing up, as a condition of taking this money, you've got to do a couple things. You've got to stop throwing people out of their homes for a year. You have to have a moratorium on foreclosures. And because of your shenanigans, everybody's mortgage was inflated, so you're going to have to reduce everybody's mortgage by 25 or 30%. That would have helped everybody. Or they could have said, by taking this money, you got to stop trading in these ridiculous instruments called collateralized debt obligations or derivatives on mortgages. And they didn't do that. And so, you know, we're left in a situation where it's still too big to fail with these bankers. And you know, this is a real problem about representation. And then let me talk a little bit about Wisconsin, because that's what I've really gotten to know over the last year. I used to think that Chapter 11 meant bankruptcy. Here in Wisconsin, Chapter 11 is the campaign finance statute, and I had to study up on that. And it's good to study up and learn something new at my age, and so I did. And then another a fun thing that I get to see at my desk, electronically come across the computer every day in my email, is the legislation that's being proposed. And it's not the horrifying thing is, it's not legislation that, number one, the candidates campaigned on. And number two, it's not legislation that there's a huge demand from the bottom for. It is very narrowly focused, special interest legislation to help out a few people or a few interests, a few industries. Here are a couple, several bills that were introduced and actually passed. One allows pipeline companies, and this is a funny thing. Right now there's legislation the Republicans have introduced to defend property right owners or expand the rights of property owners. Well, here was one they passed that actually took the rights of property owners away. You didn't hear about it, but it passed. It allows pipeline companies like Enbridge to exercise eminent domain and seize your property. So all these Republicans are claiming to be defenders of private property. They gave this ridiculous power to private industry to exercise the right of eminent domain, which is a kind of a dubious right anyway, where the government can just come in and grab your property. A lot of right-wingers hate that. Even though it's in the Constitution, but now to outsource that, to allow private companies to say we got to exercise eminent domain on your property, run a pipeline right through your land, and we're going to take it, is outrageous. If you really believe in property rights, so there's a hypocrisy there. But anyway, I didn't hear any politician talking about this during the campaign. We're going to give Enbridge, you know, the right to seize your property. Another one, and this gets back to The Big Short. This is a bill that is now a law. It allows banks in Wisconsin to offer the very same kind of loans that caused the financial crisis in 2007 and 2008. These extra low introductory rates, variable loans that were illegal in Wisconsin, they're now legal. Isn't that crazy? I mean, we learned nothing from what happened in 2007, 2008. The legislator who introduced this is a guy named Terry Katzma, who just happens to be himself a banker. And the bill itself was backed by the Wisconsin Banking Association. So, and here's another banking giveaway, payday lenders. It's bad enough that we have payday lenders that weren't disciplined even during the administration of Governor Doyle. But you got these payday lenders now who can sell more products after legislation passed this year, sponsored by Republicans, to prey on desperate consumers. And then, you know, was there a lot of clamoring about the need to give people the right to carry switchblades in Wisconsin during the elections? But there you go. Now we have the right to carry switchblades. And then there was a special piece of legislation to shield private campground owners from lawsuits. Again, not something we heard about, not something that was campaigned about. These are the kinds of things that are happening almost every day in the Capitol where lobbyists just are plying their trade. Here's one. You know, if you are delinquent in your taxes or you come and do a false tax return or fraudulent tax return, you can get into trouble. Well, there's a new law in Wisconsin that gives businesses a pass the first time they submit a false tax return. They don't get slapped on their wrist. And then if they do it again, they will get penalties, but those penalties are less than you or I get if we're doing the exact same thing. Last example, and there was no one calling for this, is more lead in paint. Who wants more lead in paint? I mean, we have UADC childcare here where my kids went in this building, and I'm sure no one in this building wants there to be more lead in paint. And one of my kids' teachers was here, and I said hi to her when I walked in. I mean, no one wants more lead in paint. Lead in paint is terrible for kids, and yet that passed. Now in Wisconsin, there can be a higher percentage of lead in paint. Another thing that people were really clamoring for. And unfortunately, I'm worried that it's going to get worse. And it's going to get worse because of this new campaign finance law that was passed at midnight last month. I was there in the Senate chamber. I was literally the only person up there except for a cop and a page. I could only stay until about 10:30 because it was so disgusting, and I was tired. But the camera, there was no cameraman. It was just the camera from Wisconsin High was there. I was sitting in the front row right next to it, and no one else was there. The media was there on the ground floor. I wasn't allowed on the ground floor. And they were just ramming the sucker through, this new campaign finance law. I'm just going to go over a couple of things that it does. And you'll see how it's just making our system more of a plaything for the very rich and for corporations. Because, first of all, it doubles the amount that anyone, though not anyone can afford it, that anyone can give to a candidate. So now, it used to be if you're running for governor, the most, if you're a millionaire, the most you could give to that candidate directly was $10,000. Now, if you're a multimillionaire and you have $20,000 floating around, you can write the governor or the candidate for governor a $20,000 check. Worse, it allows individuals to give unlimited amounts of money to political parties and legislative campaign committees. The law used to be, until a judge tore down the ceiling, that you could give only an aggregate of $10,000 total in any campaign season. If you wanted to give $10,000 to the Democratic Party, you could do that, but then you couldn't give to any candidate. If you wanted to give $10,000 to Governor Walker, you could do that, and you couldn't give to any other candidate or any political party. All you could spend was $10,000. The U.S. Supreme Court in the McCutcheon decision basically said that's wrong, and then Judge Randa agreed, and so the ceiling was torn down. But it didn't require our legislature to say you can now give unlimited amounts of money to political parties. But that's where we are now. People can give unlimited donations to political parties and campaign committees. And this, for the first time in more than 100 years, corporations in Wisconsin can now give directly to political parties. And it's just unbelievable. And then the thing that really, where the rubber meets the road, is this question of coordination between candidates and so-called outside committees. Before we get there, there's one other thing. It took away the requirement of people who are contributing donations to campaigns to list their employer. This is an important thing for us at the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. It's an important thing for people who work in the media. And it's an important thing for citizens, because citizens need to know where the money is coming from and which industries are benefiting from this specific legislation. So up to now in Wisconsin, you have to list it. If you give to a federal candidate, you have to list your employer. These folks who've captured the Republican Party, and it's not all Republicans. There's a real good Republican named up in Green Bay. What's his name? Give it to me. I'm losing my memory. Anyway, it'll come. Anyway, he voted against the campaign finance bill. He was the only Republican to vote against it. Rob Coles, Senator Rob Coles. There we go. I got about a 45-second delay. Senator Rob Coles voted against it courageously. But it's going to be a lot more difficult now for people to figure out who's benefiting from the legislation. For instance, Ashley Furniture. The people who run Ashley Furniture aren't named Ashley. So if you're trying to look at who's benefiting from this Weedick loan to Ashley Furniture, it used to be you could put into the Government Accountability Board database or the database we have at the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, Ashley Furniture. And boom, you get all the people who worked at Ashley Furniture. And you could see how much money they were giving to Walker or whoever was introducing the legislation or whoever was, you know, in charge of Weedick. It's going to be harder to do that now. They used to say, the apologists for this, for taking that requirement out, say, well, why, if I'm head of the company, should I be held responsible for what my janitor is doing, who he or she is paying for? Well, it's usually not the janitor who's giving a lot of money to the candidates. It's usually that CEO himself or herself. So this was a ridiculous argument. But this idea that you can now coordinate with candidates, it makes a mockery of our ability to limit in any rational or real way the amount of money you can, someone rich person can give to a candidate, and to require adequate disclosure. Here's an example. Even today with the $20,000 limit, say I'm running for governor, I've got a billionaire friend. I can tell my billionaire friend, you know, you could give me, my campaign, $20,000, and we'd have to disclose that you did it. But forget about that. Why don't you write a check for $20 million and give it to this outside group with some fake antiseptic name like Americans for Apple Pie? Give it $20 million to Americans for Apple Pie. I'll go work with Americans for Apple Pie. I'll tell them what ads to run with that $20 million and where to run it and how many times to run it. And the kicker is Americans for Apple Pie never have to disclose that you gave them $20 million. No one will know about it. And so it's as though he gave $20 million directly to my campaign. It has the exact same effect. And no one finds out about it. And the U.S. Supreme Court has always made a distinction. I think it's not the wisest distinction, but at least it's a distinction between direct contributions to candidates, which it says are the most potentially corrupting, and therefore we can limit them, and then outside groups, money to outside groups that can't be limited. And the reason they can't be limited is because those are really outside independent groups. But if a candidate is working with the independent group, how independent is that group? The group isn't independent. It's just part of the campaign. And so the legislators, in writing this new campaign finance law, they legislated that it is now okay for candidates to coordinate with outside groups. And in doing so, they were ratifying a decision or putting into the statutes a decision that the state Supreme Court made back in July. And we have a very corrupt Wisconsin Supreme Court here. The four conservative justices benefited from the expenditures, $8 million of expenditures from some of the very groups that were involved in the John Doe, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, Wisconsin Club for Growth. But they, in this case in July, this John Doe case, they closed it down. They reiterated that in their decision on December 2nd. And they said in their decision that the First Amendment requires coordination or prohibits states from blocking coordination between candidates and outside groups. And the thing is, and this is why it's so important that we get an appeal of this state Supreme Court decision. And there is the potential for that appeal. This was a little campaign we ran at the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign right before the end of last year, urging D.A. Ish Ozon here in Madison and Dane County and John Chisholm in Milwaukee County and Larry Nelson in Iowa County to join or petition the state Supreme Court to join the case so that they could appeal the decision up to the U.S. Supreme Court. The reason the John Doe prosecutor couldn't appeal it himself is because he was fired by the state Supreme Court on December 2nd. That left no one to appeal it. And the state Supreme Court, after Shirley Abramson scolded them, they said, yeah, you got a point here. There's no one left who could possibly appeal it. So they invited the DAs to petition the state Supreme Court to join the case. Now, it's possible that this corrupt state Supreme Court will rescind the invitation that they offered and reject their petition to join the case even after they offered them to do so. That would be a scandal. They're not afraid of scandal, these justices. They bathe in scandal, but there you have it. But I wanted to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court because it's an outrageous tying of our hands and it's going to corrupt the system more. And even legalistically, what the state Supreme Court did is completely 180 degrees from what the U.S. Supreme Court has said in 40 years of decisions on campaign finance, where it's drawn a firm line between independent expenditures and direct contributions to candidates. In Buckley versus Valeo in 1976, the landmark campaign finance case, the court said the absence of prearrangement and coordination of an expenditure with the candidate alleviates the danger that expenditures will be given as a quid pro quo. So this is requiring non-coordination. Even in Citizens United, which I'm going to talk more about, horrible decision in 2010, but one part of the decision was good because it maintained this distinction. It said, by definition, an independent expenditure is political speech presented to the electorate that's not coordinated with the candidate. So I don't know how the state Supreme Court can say the First Amendment requires you to allow coordination when in black and white in these two huge decisions, the U.S. Supreme Court said just the opposite. So I want to say just a few more words about what's going on in Wisconsin, because there is what I call, we're in the midst of a counter-revolution here, a counter-revolution against not just Governor Doyle and not just against, you know, the Great Society programs, not just against FDR, but against fighting Bob La Follette. I mean, they want to turn the clock back more than 100 years here. And it's not just Walker. Sometimes I think we spend too much time on Walker, demonizing Walker. Walker is a servant of the Koch brothers. Walker's a servant of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Walker's a servant of ALEC. The American Legislative Exchange Council is actually a member of ALEC. And so is that other group that has captured power in the Republican Party. Robin Voss, Scott Fitzgerald, Leah Vukmir is senior vice president of ALEC or something. And the American Legislative Exchange Council is this group of corporations and state elected officials who meet in private and decide what pieces of legislation to endorse among themselves, and then the corporations send the elected officials back to their state houses around the country and tell them to go run with this legislation and push it through. And in legislatures that are dominated by Republicans or pro-business Democrats, and where there's a governor of a similar ilk, they get, you know, that's the agenda. I mean, it's not an accident what happened in Wisconsin. And it didn't come out of the blue. This is strictly out of the playbook of the Koch brothers, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. And I've seen these people work up close. And they're kind of like high school bullies. They're cliquish, and they're condescending, and they're dismissive, and they laugh and sneer. I'm reminded of the Ozymandias poem by Shelley, "The Sneer of Cold Command." And they have this sneer of cold command. And it'll come to them because no one holds power forever. That's what that poem's all about. But they think they're going to be in power forever. And they don't give a damn about democracy. That is the crucial thing about these folks. They're in it for power, ego, money, for the game that is politics that they seem to like to play, just, you know, as though they're just playing a meaningless game of chess or something. They don't give a damn about clean and open government. They tried to get rid of open records in a surprise attack last July 4th weekend. They tried another ridiculous thing with this question about transitory records that the Public Records Commission is going to try to review next week. This is a thing where the people on the Public Records Commission, including some archivists, said, well, not every little communication that you get is necessarily required that you keep. You know, if you get a message about, you know, what groceries you should pick up on your way home, if that happens to come on your business phone or text or a computer, maybe that's a transitory thing, you don't have to keep it. That was the rationale for saying you can destroy transitory records. Well, within 24 hours, the Walker administration seized on that to say they don't have to release transitory records, emails or text messages about the Minahan $500,000 Weedick loan. That has never been repaid, or tell us, you know, who's been staying over in the governor's mansion during the presidential election effort, hapless as it was, of Scott Walker, and we should be able to know that. But so they seized on that loophole. We got to close that loophole. In a larger way, they don't really have a sense or any respect for the public good, a sense that there's something larger than individuals grabbing power or making profit, that there's some common weal, commonwealth, working together that we all need to do through our elected officials. That sense of something greater, of something communal, is just totally lost on them. And instead, you know, it's let's grab as much power as fast as we can. And so there's a little sinister symbiosis going on here, because they grab that power with the money that they get from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and the Koch brothers, and then they run through legislation and policies that benefit the Koch brothers and Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and then they get more money from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and the Koch brothers. That's how the thing goes. And this is happening not just in Wisconsin. We've had an up-close and personal view of it over the last 5 years. Not a pretty picture, but that's what's going on. It's not a new fight, though, and I think it's important for us to remember that this fundamental battle over money and politics has been going on almost from the first day of our democracy. Thomas Jefferson warned us almost 200 years to this day, "I hope we shall crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations." I found that quote in the dissent by Justice John Paul Stevens in the Citizens United case. It was in a footnote, and it's just a delicious quote. "I hope we shall crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations." And then 150 years ago, Wisconsin Supreme Court Chief Justice Edward Ryan was talking to the law school, and he warned, "There's a looming and new dark power, The enterprises of the country are aggregating vast corporate combinations of unexampled capital, boldly marching not for economic conquest only, but for political power. For the first time really in our politics, he said, money is taking the field as an organized power. Well, money's really taking the field these days, and it wins almost all the time. I mean, it's the aristocracy, the money corporations, you know, they weren't in their crib when he was saying that 150 years ago, and they're not in their crib today. He continued, Chief Justice Edward Ryan, the question will arise and arise in your day, though perhaps not fully in mine. Which shall rule, wealth or man? Which shall lead, money or intellect? Who shall fill public stations, educated and patriotic free men, or the feudal serfs of corporate capital? And so you know who picked up on this feudal serf line? Of course, Fighting Bob La Follette did. He was in the audience. He was in that law school class when the Chief Justice was issuing that cry from the heart. But a more recent Wisconsin politician, also a Republican, former Senator Dale Schultz, former majority leader of the Republican State Senate, who I've become good friends with over the last year, very courageous man. He voted against Act 10. He was the only Republican to do so. He voted against the mining bill. And when he decided not to run again, he was complaining about the influence of the American Legislative Exchange Council. And he said, why are we even legislators if we're just going to sit here and be a go-between between Alec and the introduction of the bills that Alec wrote anyway? And then these are his words. We've become feudal serfs for folks with a lot of money. So there's the echo of feudal serfs, and I just love that. I have a hope. One of the reasons I have hope is because people across party lines in the United States, by vast margins, understand this issue. We get this issue in our gut, that there's just too much money out there, and it's having too much of an influence not only over our economy but over our political system. There was a recent New York Times CBS poll, I think. 84% of the public agreed that money has too much influence over our politics. 80% of Republicans agreed with that. 78% said money spent by outside groups during campaigns should be limited, even though the U.S. Supreme Court and the state Supreme Court said no. 73% of Republicans agreed with that. This is just across the board, and we've seen it in this election, not only with Bernie Sanders, but Donald Trump. You remember the first debate? Donald Trump was up there. He says, you know, I've given money to almost all these guys, and when I give money to them, they answer my phone call or they answer the knock on the door. And even Hillary Clinton, I gave her money, and so what happened? She sat in the front row of my third wedding or whatever number of wedding it was of his. And the problem is that most people who are given this kind of money, they aren't doing for the vanity of getting the first lady to sit in the front row of their wedding. It's so that they can get something from our government, get something from our tax dollars, a special subsidy, a tax break, a contract, something. This is the real problem with our democracy, that money has corrupted it so badly. Elizabeth Warren has talked about it all the time. She talks about our government is rigged. If you go back on your computer this afternoon and look up Elizabeth Warren and our government is rigged, you can find this YouTube speech of hers, which is just tremendous, 2 or 3 minutes, 5 minutes of it. It's amazing. And Hillary Clinton, both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have made a pledge about the U.S. Supreme Court. They've made a pledge to actually have a litmus test, and most candidates running for president will dodge that. No, I don't have any litmus test. They all have litmus tests, I think, but they never say they do. Well, here, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton said, yeah, I do have a litmus test. What is the litmus test? Well, it's not about abortion rights. The litmus test is about nominating someone to the U.S. Supreme Court who will overturn the Citizens United decision. They both have come out in public for that. So even though I quoted the Citizens United decision in a favorable way at the beginning, I'm now going to quote its horrendous parts. Because there were, in this decision, I think, the two most naive statements ever written by a Supreme Court majority decision. Here's the first one. Independent expenditures, including those made by corporations, do not give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption. And then the second sentence is, the appearance of influence or access, furthermore, will not cause the electorate to lose faith in our democracy. And you just got to wonder, you know, what planet these people are on. People have already lost faith in our democracy. People know in their hearts and in their guts that the system's corrupt. And so it's a real problem. We've got to do something about it. Another reason I have hope, people are doing something about it. There's 16 states that have gone on record saying they want to amend the Constitution to overturn the Citizens United decision. And it's not just the Citizens United decision. It's 140 years of legal doctrine that says corporations are persons. And then Wisconsin has something to be proud of in this respect. We are the state with the second most number of communities that have gone on record saying that they want to amend the Constitution in the same way, second only to Massachusetts. And 60 villages, towns, cities, and counties in Wisconsin, all across the state, not just in places like Dane County and Madison, but even in red Waukesha, people have voted by overwhelming margins that they want to amend the U.S. Constitution to say corporations aren't persons and money isn't speech. And Waukesha was 69%. So this is a very promising movement. And I'm hoping in my lifetime we will get this amendment. I'm an impatient man. You know, I don't want to wait for, you know, people always say, well, the pendulum's going to swing. I don't want to wait for the pendulum to swing. I may not have time to wait for the pendulum to swing, so I want everybody to give the pendulum a big shove in the pro-democracy direction. Fighting Bob La Follette 100 years ago said, the cure for the ills of democracy is more democracy, and that's what we need, more democracy here in Wisconsin, across the country. But I don't get discouraged. Maybe it's a character flaw. But, you know, I'm a student of Howard Zinn's, and Howard Zinn has taught us in A People's History of the United States and in his other writings, and it was great to have him write for the Progressive the last 12 years of his life, that nothing is static. History isn't static. That even though it seems like things are impossible, there are always people working everywhere to try to make things better, and at some point with people pushing and shoving from below, change happens. And so I wanted to quote a little something from Howard Zinn. And then I have one other quote, and then I'll shut up. So, here's Howard Zinn. To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It's based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. And that's really true. It paralyzes us. But if we remember the times and places, he said, and there are many such times and places, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act and at least the possibility of sending this spinning top of a world in a different direction. I do love that little spinning top. He concluded, to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory. Isn't that a sweet, sweet little paragraph? And it's kind of like Gandhi, too. You know, be the change you want to see in the world. Final quote isn't from Zinn or Gandhi or La Follette or Thomas Jefferson. It's from Seamus Heaney, great Irish poet who died just a couple years back. He has a terrific poem called The Cure at Troy. I'm not going to recite the whole poem, but there's an incredible line in there, something to the effect, there are times in our lives when hope and history rhyme. We need to make hope and history rhyme again here in Wisconsin and across the country. Thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you very much, Matt. We have about 15 minutes for questions and comments. John.
Matt, you mentioned in your bio that you're a birder, and I know you also believe in nature conservancies, preserving lands, you know, for nature. And you were remarking on Facebook earlier this week that what happened down in Oregon was a desecration of the nature conservancy there. Could you relate this to the so-called populist movement on the far right that says government is bad, individual rights need to be restored, that embraces the Constitution in ways that I imagine you also agree are a desecration? How do we respond to that? Because you also can reflect on these lands out in eastern Oregon where I know you spent much time.
Yeah, I've been there once. I've been dying to get back to the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. It's a tremendous, beautiful place. It's known for having great shorebirds, black-necked stilts, which is a beautiful black and white bird on tall red legs, and then the American avocet, which we don't get in Wisconsin very often, though I did see one. I did see 17 at Nine Springs one day. But it's a gorgeous black and white bird with a tan neck and a huge upturned bill like this. You know, curlews have bills like this. This is one of the only birds that has a huge bill, thin bill like this, an avocet. Anyway, it's a gorgeous place. It's really sublime, surreal, ethereal place. And that these people are there desecrating it does just make me sick to my stomach and challenges my pacifist belief. They are kind of drunk with the ideology that is so prevalent today here in Wisconsin and across the country, the ideology that everything public is bad and everything private is good. This notion that there's nothing that the government does for the public that is good and therefore all should be turned into private property is just ludicrous, and it's manifested there. Our national wildlife refuges, you know, here in Wisconsin, a Horicon Wildlife Refuge, or the state parks that we have in Wisconsin, you know, Wyalusing State Park. You know, our government here in Wisconsin not paying for our state parks anymore. And they're doing frac sand mining right next to Wyalusing State Park right now, one of the great bird-watching places in Wisconsin for warblers. It's just astonishing that this ideology has taken such hold. And, of course, everybody or a lot of people have been making the sensible observation over the last week that if this was Black Lives Matter coming in with guns capturing a government building, you can imagine they wouldn't be treated so gently right now and so heroically on right-wing media for that matter. So this is partly an ideological problem about public is bad, private is good, and it's part of an ideology out west that's been taking place over the course now of 40 years in response to the environmental movement.
How do we counter that?
Well, I think we need to counter it in ways here locally. Right now, there's legislation. Wisconsin League of Conservation Voters, a great group, has been working on just today, this week, trying to challenge some legislation that would allow private property owners to dredge out of our lakes, you know, like 3 truckloads every year of sediment out of the lake. It's just amazing what's going on. One of the fun things about my job over the last year, after being at the Progressive, which is national and international, and our old editor, Irwin Knoll, who was a tremendous man and could be a little bit sometimes on the pompous side, I asked him what the mission of the Progressive was. He says, it's to save the world. And, you know, I'm happy if I can help try to save Wisconsin a little bit at this point in my life. So I think that's one thing is to work with groups like League of Conservation Voters on this issue. Midwest Environmental Advocates, another great environmental group. And all the pro-democracy groups in Wisconsin, League of Women Voters, Andrea Kaminsky, incredible person, great group, Common Cause, JHEC. I mean, it's just been so wonderful for me to get to know these people. And then there are people at 9 to 5 and other groups in Milwaukee that are doing great organizing, especially people who are a generation or so younger than me. And that gives me hope, too. There are a lot of tremendous people with great energy and intellect across the nonprofit sector in Wisconsin that we don't see very often. But they're all doing the work heroically, and I think that's what's going to make the difference. We also have some good elected officials in the state capitol. A lot of our women legislators are really good on the Democratic side, I think, and then a couple good ones on the Republican side, too. Todd Hodgkiss, a Republican out of Dodgeville, broke with the party on some important issues, too. So it's not a partisan thing. So that was half an answer. Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about investigative journalism and what has happened in this country that doesn't allow us to hear all the information that we need to have?
Well, there's a real crisis in journalism. I'm a real good friend of Bob McChesney's, and Bob McChesney and John Nichols have been writing about the collapse of journalism in America for the last 15, 20 years. And it's just, I mean, how can you encourage, I don't know what they're teaching in journalism school these days, because how can you encourage any student or kid of yours or grandkid of yours to go into journalism when there are no jobs? I mean, the job sector has been decimated in mainstream journalism right now. There are cutbacks and layoffs constantly. I mean, Doug Moe, the best writer in Madison, was unceremonially kicked out of the state journal one day and told in the morning that he had to pack up and leave by the end of the afternoon. And the irony is that the state journal was advertising Doug Moe as a reason to subscribe. You'd see it on the buses or the billboards. Doug Moe, you know, Moe, M-O-E, period, come to the state journal. And then they kicked the guy out of that office. I mean, it was unbelievable, and it wasn't just Doug Moe. Some of the best local sports reporters, which is an area of specialty. People want to read the paper for the local sports coverage, and foolishly, they got rid of a couple of them, too. But investigative journalism especially is on the chopping block because it's expensive, and the corporations that own the papers don't want to spend the money to hire the investigative reporters to do that kind of legwork that's necessary. I think we are lucky in Wisconsin. There are some good investigative reporters at the Wisconsin State Journal and the Journal Sentinel who are doing a lot of work. They uncovered this thing about the transitory records, for instance. In fact, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel today on its front page was campaigning in a way that I haven't seen journalism campaign in a long time. Front page story, call the Public Records Commission. Here's their numbers. Call them and tell them to rescind their decision. And this is campaigning public sector, public service journalism, the likes of which we don't see very often. They also said in two editorials, Robin Voss doesn't have the personality that is necessary to serve in the state capitol. Please run against him, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. Here's how you sign up to run. I mean, it was really amazing. I think sometimes we trash our papers in Wisconsin, but I think compared to other papers, they're actually doing a pretty good job, and I know some of those, I've gotten to know some of those daily journalists over the last couple of years, and we have the Wisconsin Investigative Journalism Group with Dee Hall and her husband, and they're doing great work too, but generally, there's been a huge cutback in reporters in state capitals across the country, and who does that favor? Who likes that? The corporations that are passing their own bills that they are writing, like this, the GTEC mining bill was written by GTEC. And if you didn't have reporters out there pointing that out, and they're not reporters in every state capital as good as the reporters we have here in Madison. So it's a field day, it's a picnic for the corporations. They're getting their favors from the taxpayers, even though the taxpayers don't know about it. So it's a real crisis. At some point, McChesney and Nichols say we have to subsidize journalism. That's their answer. I don't know if that's going to happen anytime soon, but it certainly would be an answer. Another different model is for newspapers to become like NPR or like The Progressive, for that matter, and just to go nonprofit. Just yesterday, I saw something. I think a Fairbanks, Alaska paper is going nonprofit. I mean, you can imagine New York Times going nonprofit and then begging people for money like NPR does or like The Progressive does. I'm sure they'd get money that way. And what would they lose? Only they wouldn't have to write editorials saying, vote for this person, don't vote for that. And that doesn't have much play anymore. I mean, that doesn't have much clout anymore. And the conceit now of the Republicans in Wisconsin is newspaper editorials don't mean anything. Because the newspaper editorials were great on the question of this campaign finance bill that I talked about. They were great on the John Doe bill. They were great on the Government Accountability Board bill. But the legislators didn't care. Why didn't they care? Because they know they're going to get enough money from the people who are paying them to push these bills through to drown out these editorialists come election time with their own ads on TV and on radio. That's the cynicism. So for papers to stay for profit just so they can endorse candidates doesn't make sense. I think a nonprofit journalism model is a better model. I think that'll be coming.
What has to happen to keep people who are puppets from being elected, like Walker and Bush and these idiots who don't know what they're doing but are simply spouting out whatever somebody else tells them to do? How do we get out of that cycle?
Yeah, how do we stop people from being elected who are puppets of the people who pay them or who are idiots like former President George W. Bush? That wasn't my characterization, for the record.
You're right to quote.
Well, I think we need to educate ourselves and our neighbors around election time. I mean, two things. One, I think what the last 5 years have taught us in Wisconsin is how important local and statewide elections are. I mean, there are a lot of people in this town, good progressive people. I used to live on one block from West High School, who cared a lot about war and peace issues and cared a lot about big justice issues with a capital J, didn't know who their state senator was or their state rep was, and didn't actually vote in the state in the local elections. And so we've seen the tragedy of that myopia just in front of our eyes over the last 5 years. So that's one big thing. And the other thing is just to return to a grassroots kind of political organizing. Because the real crucial thing is to convince people who we know but who don't agree with us that actually our view of the world or our view of democracy, our view of what this country should be, is actually a more just and humane and fair vision than what the other people are thinking, the other candidates are thinking. And one thing that concerns me in a place like Madison, and this is true on the right as well, is we can talk only to people who agree with us and have a nice day doing it, too. I mean, we can wake up and listen to Democracy Now or watch it on TV and go to our nice nonprofit like I've been doing for 35 years and be with people who only agree with me, or go to the university where your colleagues are pretty much the same, and then come home and read The Nation, The Progressive, and turn on MSNBC and go on Facebook with all your left-wing or liberal progressive friends and call it a night. And the right does the same thing with, you know, they'll listen to Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and being on an IV drip from Fox News all day long. And so, you know, people are, you know, the art of politics, I think, is convincing people who don't agree with you. And so we need to really talk to people who don't agree with us. And I think that's a way we need to go.
To piggyback on that last comment, Catherine's, we have people running now from that don't believe in government. And we're talking about the whole Tea Party. You have people running that don't want to do anything once they get in. And that's even worse than puppetry.
Well, there is a kind of nihilism out there. I'm worried about the country right now with Donald Trump and with this kind of anti-government sentiment, or let's just destroy everything public. And so we just have to try to make the case that, you know, there's a better way of doing things. Trump bothers me for his neo-fascism. I mean, let's be blunt about it. Because his talk about, he's got this ad about no Muslims can come into the United States. You know, people were thinking maybe that was he misspoke, maybe he'll backtrack. No, he's going straight forward with this thing and building that huge border because of all the terrible people from south of the border who are coming in. I mean, this is traditional fascism. And the ending theme, which he ended the last Republican debate with, and which he ended this commercial with, will make America great again. We'll be great again. These are really kind of fascist appeals. And I think we need to be very careful of those.
I need some advice. I'm under the cloud of Citizens United, and in the past I've given kind of nickel and dime contributions to campaigns and to the party, and I'm feeling that there's no place for me in doing that any longer, and when I can't support a candidate,
Well, I think Planned Parenthood is a great group, number one. And the people working at Planned Parenthood that I've gotten to know in Wisconsin are terrific. We're trying to do small experiments this coming year here in 2016 at the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign with other groups like League of Women Voters and Common Cause and WISPIRG and People for the American Way to try to boost up the power of the small donor. It's called small donor empowerment. In New York City, for instance, in municipal elections, if you give $100, the city of New York matches that six times. So your donation of $100 is worth $700. So that's an interesting thing that we're seeing if we can do in places like La Crosse or other places here. I do think certainly candidates who are good candidates would want you to give money, even though it seems like a drop in the bucket. The other thing we're doing, this just happened in Seattle in November. They passed a municipal law that says every citizen of Seattle gets four $25 vouchers that can be spent on any person running for office for city council or for mayor. So you could give all four of them, $100, to your favorite candidate for mayor, or you could sprinkle them around. And again, these are versions of public financing. Ultimately, we've got to get to a situation of public financing. And these are small-scale experiments in that.
I used to listen to Sly on the radio, and while I think the people who focus on a lot of things, he at least brought a lot of local issues to the forefront. Who do we listen to now? You know, I listen to Warren, but still, you don't have that dedicated person. And now the Sly is out in the hinterland. He's not as active as he used to be, and I understand that that's
the problem where he is now. Well, I appreciate the question. I love doing radio, and so I'll go on any radio show that invites me. So there's Progressive Radio on 92.1.
Yeah, that's national.
But there are two local shows. One is The Devil's Advocates in the afternoon with Dom and Crudy. My wife can't stand the show. because she thinks it's just, you know, guys at a bar talking, basically. I enjoy them. I think it's interesting radio. And then there's the Mitch Hanks show in the morning, and he's kind of ambiguous about his politics. And it's not a perfect fit on progressive radio because he's not a self-identified progressive. He's just kind of a political junkie. But I was on a show this morning, and I will go on a show whenever I can. I guest hosted for it on Christmas Eve, and that was fun having 3 hours, just me and being able to bring on anybody I wanted. So that was kind of fun. I do love Joy Cardine on Wisconsin Public Radio. I think she does a terrific job, a wonderful person, very fair. I like being on the Friday show there where I'm debating some conservative. So I think there are some avenues still. And WRT, as you say, is great.
Thanks.
There's one more over here.
My checkbook is here. Have you ever considered a run for office?
No. My mother, bless her heart, would be happy to hear the question, but she wouldn't be happy to hear the answer, though. No, I am long past that.
Thanks very much, Matt.
Thank you.
The preceding program was recorded and produced by John Quinlan for the broadcast and podcast editions of Forward Forum. The decade-old award-winning Forward Forum program, which has its roots in commercial and community radio, is now being produced as a project of the oral history and storytelling journalism nonprofit Voices in Support of Community. This work is made possible in part by the generous support of the EVU Foundation, the production assistance of the Sun Prairie Media Center, and by a growing network of organizational partners, individual donors, and philanthropic institutions. For more information and for access to recent archived Forward Forum shows, please go to www.forwardforum.net. That's forwardforum.net.